Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. This is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Alan Lane about his new book, The Club on the Edge of Town, a pandemic memoir. So welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. This is possibly the best book I've read this year. Certainly the most important, perhaps. And it was, you know, brilliant on so many levels. And I've got lots and lots of questions that I want to ask you about it. And I'm sort of hopeful it's going to get a big readership and lots of listeners. But before we do that, we definitely need some kind of ground clearing to take place. And this really is a whole bunch of questions about who you are, what you do, where this memoir takes place, and I guess kind of like why it's interesting and why it matters. So to introduce you, you're part of this theatre called Slung Low. And that's probably the first question. Who are Slung Low? What do you guys do? What kind of theatre company are you?
Yeah, great. So Slung Low are a theatre company based in the north of England that has a set of values, one of which is we all get paid the same, one of which is that we are in service to our community, and we make predominantly large-scale people's theatre. So that's large shows, normally in city centres, with people who don't do this for a living, performing to make shows that you still get to hear about on Radio 4 and read about in the Times and all that good stuff. And we've been around, 20 years, and we're funded by the Arts Council. And that's probably all you need to know about Slung Low, I think.
The next kind of like stuff I need to know is probably, I was going to say, you know, where is Holbeck? But I should probably say, like, can you tell me a bit about Leeds, actually, and maybe tell me a bit about the north of England? So, yeah, like, what's so kind of interesting and special about Leeds, and where is Holbeck in relation to Leeds as well?
So, Slung Low, we say we're made in the greater north because the type of theatre that we make, kind of big sprawling shows with hundreds of people in, talking about the issues of certain places, couldn't really be made in, say, inner city London. There just isn't the real estate. So we do feel like we're kind of carved out the stone of the north. And we've been based in Leeds for a really long time now, and specifically an inner city ward called Holbeck, which was the heart of the Industrial Revolution for about, you know, like 5 minutes back at the beginning of the Victorian era. And then since then has got slammed by every possible economic and social movement. So deindustrialization kind of killed it. There was a whole series of post-war decline. Thatcher jumped up and down on it. Austerity really did for it. And then COVID came along and kind of knocked it about. So it's still got the worst health outcomes of any ward in England. But it is the most extraordinary place. And if you guys were all here now, we could go to a Turkish supermarket where you'd have the best kebab in the north of England. We could go to Ingram Road Primary School where 40 different languages are being spoken. And it is an amazing, vibrant and brilliant place. And we moved here 10 years ago, partly because we were worried that we were becoming a bit of a fireworks company. We went wherever the commissions were, did something for 3 months and then came home. And we wanted to be rooted. And I think every theatre company has to have a hill that they're willing to die on, and ours is Holbeck. Our job is to serve the people of Holbeck with the best cultural life we possibly can, on the understanding that we spend £500 million worth of public money every year, and some of that should be spent on the cultural life of the people of Holbeck. And it's our job to leverage that, cultural capital from knowing people like you, from being able to get in the press, from being able to get commissioned at the RSC or any of the other things that we can do and bring some value or financial value back to Holbeck. In the last 3 years, we have done that by having our headquarters and running the oldest working men's club in Britain, which is called The Holbeck, which is in a brilliant 250-seater cabaret space, lounge bars, snooker room, you know, kind of classic working men's club. And everything we do here is on a pay-what-you-decide basis, and it operates as a community and creative space for everybody.
I suppose the story of the club is the story of the book, but also the book tells the story of the pandemic, and it also tells a story about what the arts are for, how we should kind of organise Britain, how we should organise society, and actually many other quite touching personal stories as well. I guess, as you'd mentioned there, you know, this 3 year relationship with the club, there's probably quite a few models of arts organisations having these relationships with institutions in places that maybe were not designed to kind of hold particular kinds of theatre or particular community activities. But there's something I think particularly kind of unique that's going on in your story. And one of them actually is the club itself. And you'd mentioned, you know, its status as a working man's club and a very well established, you know, working man's club. But at the same time, at the start of the book, it's in pretty serious trouble. And I'm quite intrigued by sort of what the problems facing the place were, and they're actually the problems of you know, the kind of the local area more generally, but also what got you, as you say, you know, this theatre company that does, you know, sort of big, impressive, huge shows. What got you thinking that this would be the venue for you to place yourselves in?
So I think, immediately the problems were that this is a members club that is reliant in their current business model on people coming into a room with no windows and spending large amounts of money on booze in order to keep a much larger building open. And so, like all clubs, social clubs like this, the decline in drinking, the increase in home drinking, the decline in, when they brought in the smoking ban, and also the communities moving in around the club that either don't have a cultural history of drinking in places like this or just don't drink, all of that contributes to the fact that the sort of post-war model of a bar that makes money in order to be a social space for the people of a place, it just doesn't work anymore. People don't drink enough. What I find absolutely fascinating, and the reason why I got really excited about the club, was this place was built in 1877 and it didn't have a bar for 50 years. It was a lecture hall and a games room. It was a place where people came to be entertained and educated. It was only in the 20th century, when the kind of the subs decreased because wages went lower, that they decided to kind of, if you like, capitalize on the fact that so much of their workforce were alcoholics, that if men were going to go and spend money in a place, they might as well be owned cooperatively by the community, which is brilliant because everybody got to go on holiday to Blackpool, but is as flawed as any other model. The thing that's really catching up with this club, and was catching up with this club and is catching up with lots of others, is that it only defines its community as a very small sliver of Holbeck. In this instance, sometimes that's along racial issues, sometimes it's along gender issues, but in this instance, it literally defines people who want to come to a place and drink. Now, like any community, Holbeck is diverse, but it doesn't have people who want to do that. So the problem we found when we arrived was that it was in unbelievable amounts of debt, and its business plan was just going to increase that debt because it could not sell enough booze. Now, we believe that if you're going to have a theatre company in the neighbourhood, there should be some perks. So we do a lot of Christmas. We do a lot with the local schools. We lend out our van. There should just be perks to having professional artists knocking around the place. And for us, one of those was, we've got to have an office. We might as well have an office here. And along the way, we were able to bring a kind of real financial stability to the club. But based on, and this was the argument that we've never really been able to win with the members, based on the idea that the building can be more useful to its community, it can be useful to its community in more ways than just providing booze. And that, I think, is at the heart of nearly all of these social clubs, where retired people simply cannot believe that people want to spend their social time in other ways other than drinking alcohol. And I think that's a real kind of intellectual problem, you know, right at the heart of the philosophies of this club. But for the last 3 years, it's been a community and social club, and it's financially thrived as a result of it, but not because we've sold more beer.
The sort of front end of the book, you do two things. You set out what you were doing initially, and you've sort of gestured to that already, you know, the sense of doing something, a range of some things that were not just selling booze to the usual suspects. But at the same time, you kind of grapple with this big idea about what cultural democracy might be like for the theatre company, the local area, and I think more sort of generally. And I suppose understanding this idea of cultural democracy gives us a route into the kind of activities you did. So what is that term, and what does that idea mean?
Well, I mean, I'm loath to define it in front of an academic, but for us here, cultural democracy is about the idea that the bloke that lives next door has as much right to define what good culture is as I do as a professional artist, and how that manifests, that culture belongs to all of us. And actually, Alan Lane's definition of culture is no less, but certainly no more important than anyone else's. And we've got into trouble in this nation in the last 50 or 60 years by having an incredibly small very few types of people defining what good culture is. And as a result, the vast majority of our population has moved away from a kind of recognized culture and especially art, and felt quite disconnected from it all because the number of people defining what it was too small. And so here in like practically what that means for us in the Holbeck is that if you're part of our community, you can program whatever you want. If you come to me and say, I really want a comedy about the Old Testament, I'll find a comedy about the Old Testament. If you come to me and say, I don't want you to program anything, Alan, I want the room because I'm going to put on my own event, then we'll get out the way. If that involves hoovering up after you and putting the sound system on, then that's what we need to do. And actually what we've discovered in having a kind of almost basically open policy when it comes to who gets to operate the levers of cultural power, such as they are in Sunglo, is that everything works. Pretty much everything, apart from a few sort of fundraisers for political parties and some other stuff like that, has been successful within its own terms. So when the bloke down the road puts a Battle of the Bands on because his neighbour's got his bike nicked and he wants to raise money for it, me and you, as people who go to the theatre a lot, might sit and watch that show and go, Jesus Christ, this is a car crash. It's not very slick. However, the people who are there have a whale of a time, and the band sing, and that's their point, and they raise loads of money, and the guy gets his bike back. We've lived in a world for too long where I suppose people like me and you come along and go, no, 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 that won't do. Or even worse, we go, oh, there's a risk to putting this on. And you go, what's the risk? Because I have had award-winning, celebrated national newspaper talked about theatre here, of which three people have come and watched. And apparently that is not as much of a risk as letting Bronya crack on and put a birthday party on for her grandmother, where 200 people will come and sing and dance and do all the things that we might want them to do at a piece of theatre. So that's, for us, a kind of grappling with the idea of cultural democracy, that people get to choose what has value, and then giving them as much of the levers of power as we possibly can. I think that's what we've been about.
I mean, that choice, I think there are a few people who will be listening to this podcast that would sort of disagree with that. And I think you'd have a sense of, like, you know, that sounds amazing. Everything should be like that. But one of the things that I really like about the book is you don't shy away from the difficulty of choices, and particularly how you know, parts of the institution were sort of, you know, quite, I guess, hostile to some of that cultural freedom that you were trying to offer to the community. And this is both sort of fascinating in terms of it's not usually the kind of the difficulty that we associate with stuff like cultural democracy. Usually, as you've said, it's to do with the idea of, you know, risks that the aesthetics won't be high quality or whatever language we'd use. But also, actually, it, you know, it is a really quite kind of, it's, I mean, it's, I have to say the book is hilarious throughout. You know, there are some very funny moments in the book, but it is really clear that there are costs to the idea of, you know, you can throw open an institution to anyone who wants to use it. So I'm interested in what some of the tensions were with the Working Man's Club as a kind of an institution and an organization. There are various, as I say, you know, hilarious things where it turns out, you know, comedy riffs on the Prime Minister looking like a mop are massive kind of culture war battlegrounds with some of the existing members.
Yeah. I suppose one of our mottos here is that everybody gets what they want, but crucially, nobody gets to stop other people having what they want. And it's always the second part of that sentence. We've never been asked to do anything at this club that we haven't been able to do within a couple of weeks. Like, we've put on operas and drag queens and magic shows and plays and all sorts. And actually, people's demands are really very achievable. What we've had massive amounts of problem with is people not wanting other people to have what they want. So some of that is about, some of that is just, you know, the classic slung low struggle, which is the powers that be in the arts don't like the idea that everyone might get to define what good art is because they've had that position of authority and they don't want to give it up. And some of it is that, and certainly we're a pay what you decide venue and we're frowned upon by certain elements of the establishment, which is all good and proper. But closer to home and much more surprising to me was the idea that even though it is the only way forward for a kind of financial future, it is still true that, you know, we have members who get angry about the idea that the Ghanaian community, we have a particularly large Ghanaian community, will use the club. Even though they are members, like you can become a member for £6, they will still get angry about that. They will still talk about proper members and not proper members. And it's really hard sometimes to not think that they just mean white. And actually, they don't just mean white. And that's a sort of laziness on my part. What they mean is, they mean people who are willing to come and accept in totality the culture that existed before. And practically, and this is going to sound like I'm taking the mickey, and it's really not, is to sit in a room with no windows, drink a pint of beer and play bingo. And if you want to come and use this space for something else, even though it doesn't stop the people drinking the pints of beer and doing the bingo, if you want to do that other thing in a different room in the same building, you will create antagonism within the people who existed here before. Or I didn't mean that in an anthropological sense. I mean, literally in this room existed here before. And I find that fascinating because so much of that speaks, I think, the kind of macro version of the culture war, where, you know, we're absolutely furious about people arriving from other countries, even though actually it doesn't really impact on our quality of living at all. But just the sheer idea that they will not wholesale accept the cultural life and signifiers of our pre-existence, I find really extraordinary. And what that, you know, a lot of big words there, actually it just meant that people didn't like other people who didn't look like them coming in to use the space. And that is difficult. I'm not madly convinced that that's so wildly different from some of the experiences I've had in theatres. I've worked in some posh theatres in my time when, old people in blazer jackets complain that young people are laughing in the wrong parts of plays and that sort of thing. So I'm not convinced it's not a specifically Holbeck or working class experience, but it is real. And it is about holding on to the thing you've got, even if, you know, it means that you're being self-destructive.
Yeah, clapping between movements at symphonies. That, you know, something that at no point would you associate with the battleground of a working man's club, but, you know, precisely these sorts of, you're not behaving in the way that we expect you to behave, and thus, you know, you're sort of not one of us. And that would have been a brilliant topic for a book and a brilliant topic for this book. But obviously, you know, the subtitle, A Pandemic Memoir, the book radically changes as soon as 2020 hits. And, you know, the story becomes both, you know, much broader in terms of the kinds of ideas that are in the book, but also it becomes a story of, I guess, you know, your personal struggle to deal with the impact of the COVID pandemic in 2020. And I guess to distill this, and it is, I think, difficult to boil down because there was so much that you and the organization, and I mean you in the sense of the network, and the book is at pains to kind of stress the importance of the team effort and, you know, the kind of the crew that are surrounding and the community that are surrounding the Holbeck. But what sort of happened when COVID hit? How did the organization pivot to do, I guess, you know, something very different because theatres were closed, audiences weren't allowed in, but also to carry on being responsive to what the community needed at the time.
Yeah. So we closed the bar a little early because most of our members are kind of old and we're at real risk from that COVID. And we had a long chat about whether, you know, what should we do? Because at the time we were all being sent home and it felt like that may well be the safest thing to do, but it also felt kind of quite cowardly that if we all went home and came back in what we thought was going to be 3 or 4 weeks, it was going to be very hard to go back to trying to convince people who were already quite suspicious of us that we were in service to them, that like, oh no, we're on your side. But actually, when the shit hit the fan, we escaped. So we decided we wouldn't do that. And instead, we wrote a letter to our 200 nearest fan neighbours and said, we're here, we can help you. You know, we're old enough to kind of feel like we know what we're doing, but we're young enough to not be terrified of this COVID thing. And if you need anything, let us know. And they did. They got in touch. They wanted shopping and dogs walking and all sorts of bedding changing. And the council found out about that and said, that's great. Could you do it for the whole ward? And we were like, yeah, absolutely. Not really knowing what that meant. So what it meant was that the ward of 2,500, well, in the end, 8,500 households, if you rang Leeds City Council saying you needed help during COVID time, you were put through to us. And in the beginning, that meant prescriptions and dog walking and all sorts of befriending calls. But actually, quite quickly, it became about, I need food. There was an absolute crisis of income. And some of that in the beginning was to do about not being able to physically access food. But actually, that was just disguising the real problem, which was people did not have enough money to feed their families. And so we became what we learned was a non-means tested self-referral food bank, which meant that if you lived in Leeds, full stop, and you asked us for food, we would provide it. And in the end, over 15 months, we would do 15,202 food deliveries, which is a lot. And we got down towards the end to be kind of doing 400 deliveries in a day. And in order to do that, we needed to shift everything we were doing. But one of the arguments we kept having was that it was just an extension of what we were doing, but in different form. So we were still serving our community and we were still using a lot of the logistical skills that we had before. And crucially, we were telling the story. We were still storytelling and we had to raise a lot of money. And the best, quickest way of raising the money was having me go and talk about the food bank anywhere and we would get money. And so there was still a sense that we were just adapting our theatre skills in order to be in service in a different way. Although obviously it involved, you know, lots of lorries full of baked beans and all that stuff. But it was still the same mission if it's presenting itself in a slightly different way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, actually, one way of distilling that is something like the LS11 Art Gallery project, which is bound up with you delivering food and the kinds of presence you've got going round and about the ward, round and about the community, but at the same time thinking about the idea of, you know, it's still possible to do art within this. And also, which the payoff to the chapter, you're at pains to stress how working with the council, you know, these are good people. None of these people are, you know, kind of particularly evil or nasty, but also it tells you something about running up against bureaucracy that, you know, is really struggling to do what it needs to do to provide for people, but also at the same time is set up in a way to kind of stop things happening. So yeah, what was the story of the LS11 art gallery?
So when we started delivering all this food, which meant that we had a kind of privilege, which we were allowed to leave our house. In that first lockdown, no one was allowed to leave. You got to do your Boris Bimble for an hour. And we were out all the time delivering food, collecting food. And so we realized people were in their houses and scared. So we dropped a letter through. We pretty much fly the entire ward saying, look, you're trapped in your house and you're scared, but you're still brilliant. So make a piece of art, take a picture, do a painting, whatever it is, and then ring us on this number and we'll come and take a picture of it. And then we would have that printed on weatherproof boards and put them up at A0 and then put them all the lampposts so that when you went for your Boris Bimble, you would see the kind of art of your neighbours, and it was incredibly popular. It was an idea that I wasn't very taken with at first. It was the rest of the gang, and you know, goes to prove how much I know. It was incredibly popular, and the thing, firstly, that the quality of the work was extraordinary. By any sort of objective measure, it was brilliant art. And then the second thing is that it would go missing, and people would ring and say the picture's gone missing, but it wasn't vandalised. People were stealing them and putting them up in their homes. And they were putting up the art of their neighbours in their homes so they could look at it more. And I found that extraordinary. It was brilliant. And it proved to be very popular, and it was on the telly and everything else. And one night I was having a bath and the phone rang, and it was the chief lamppost engineer of Leeds City Council, who had seen us on the telly and was furious that we'd done this unbelievably dangerous thing. And I think you're right in that. I mean, this guy was a nice guy. Everyone at the council was trying their hardest, but he spent a good 10 minutes explaining how what I'd done was really dangerous, and I was for the high jump, and I all this good stuff, and that was followed by 10 minutes of me explaining to him that it had actually been commissioned by Leeds City Council, and I could go and take it down, but he would have to promise me that I wouldn't have to pay him all his money back, and I think. The thing the whole food bank, especially that moment, taught me was that there's no such thing as Leeds City Council. There is a huge, sprawling bureaucracy that it's not that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. The right hand simply does not think it's the right hand. The number of people, it's the same with the Arts Council. You sit down with people and they go, oh, I'm not really the Arts Council. And you're like, well, you got a full-time job there. It feels like you are. And they're like, no, but I'm just playing the game. And actually, I've never really met anybody who was like, yeah, I'm really into what the Leeds City Council's doing. And I'm like, well, and so much of it, you know, the using the green space more versus the actually how the parks are patrolled policy are at complete loggerheads. The funding us to be a food bank whilst a different part of the council telling us not to give away food. The paying for us to do a lamppost gallery, the chief lamppost engineer getting furious and threatening me with all sorts of nonsense. They're all examples of how actually these municipal authorities have become so large that there's barely any controlling them, because in large part, nobody who works there thinks they're responsible for anything. And that's what we discovered with the food bank thing, where we would run up against genuine, real, legal opposition from the same organisation who was funding us to do the thing we were doing. And that was a real eye-opener. The amount of bureaucracy and politics involved in giving away free bread I thought the theatre world was bad, but it's absolutely nothing in comparison to the social care world. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone wants a sort of useful primer on the kind of failings on the one hand of how we've organised the welfare state, but also, as you say, some of the real kind of binds these organizations that are trying to help end up in. And actually there's a quite poignant moment quite late on in the book, you know, where you have this, if I can call it like a run-in with a big supermarket giving away food. And there is an element of, on the one hand, you know, kind of cutting through just the bullshit of dealing with them. But on the other hand, realizing that, you know, there's going to be a couple of families that don't get a cake as a result of that. And there is, you know, a sort of, I had a real admiration for you staying, you know, sort of sane over the course of the book, having to deal with those, you know, even where institutions are trying to help, they're set up in ways that seem to be almost kind of deliberately obstructive. And to sort of pick up and develop that, sorry to cut over you, is a story of basically heroes throughout the book. And again, I've mentioned, you know, it's not your story, it's the story of community. But I wonder if there are sort of like any particular characters you'd like to pick out as real sort of, yeah, heroes from the story.
I think Liz, who is a volunteer who came to, she was a lighting designer actually, and she came to us because she knew of us through the theatre world rather than the kind of locality, and she was a big Leeds United fan, and she came, and she was like quite a large cohort of our volunteers, is that we obviously needed them, but I always got the impression she needed us slightly more, because she was very ill. We didn't really realize it, but she was very ill, and that it became obvious only afterwards that she was dying. And actually her time with us, a few months, she became physically less and less able to be able to do the kind of basic volunteering of delivering food, until finally one day she turned up in my office in a full Leeds United strip with the kind of socks pulled up, and decided she would take over the masterminding of the Christmas toy deliveries, which now I look back at it was such an obvious, it wasn't a cry for help, but an obvious, like, I'm going to have my day. I'm going to have the perfect day where I do something beautiful for 300 children, and I do it wearing my favorite clothes in all the world, even though it is absolutely ridiculous for a 50-year-old woman to wear a full football strip with the socks pulled up. And it was the most vivid example, I think, of how people gave their absolute everything. You know, the people, and in return got their absolute everything. So they were, you know, we clearly were a sort of source of stability for her over those months, which must have been, I mean, she never spoke about it, which I find incredibly sad, but they must have been horrendous to be dying in that environment of COVID, where you couldn't move around, you couldn't go see people, you couldn't hold people, and she replaced all of that with masterminding the giving away of 300 toys to children who wouldn't otherwise get them whilst wearing a football strip. And that as an example of living your best life, which sort of inspires me. I'm like, good for you, Liz. We were really lucky. We were really lucky. We were backed up by amazing volunteers who gave their all, but also by some people within the system of the city council who very quietly and without ever a curtain call sort of gently managed to keep us going, even in the face of quite a lot of corporate desire for us to stop. It's even for a Labour council, it's quite the act of political radicalism to have a food bank decide they're just going to give food to whoever wants it. And it was only after the fact that we realised there was quite a few bureaucrats who were doing a really good job of protecting us from getting shut down. And I think those people are sort of are one of the many quiet heroes of this time.
Yeah, the book is absolutely full of them, and you know each of them has even the, you know, the sort of relatively minor characters has an important role in basically ensuring what happened in 2020 happened, and in some ways perhaps offering a kind of a blueprint of what an arts organisation, you know, can and possibly should be, and one of my sort of concluding questions before I can I don't know what that was. Before I come to a general question about what's happening now, is posed by one of the chapters in the book, and really this is a code for like what did the cultural sector think. But you call one of the chapters, "Why does a theatre company run a food bank?" And I'm intrigued by your answer to that.
Well, I mean, there's the kind of basic answer, which is we are in service to the people of Holbeck, and we are committed to giving the best cultural life possible. Now, in an ideal world, I would want that to be high days and holidays and things, magical, impossible things for them to see and experience and do. But none of that was possible during that time. And the thing that really struck and was just so clear to us was that just because none of that was possible doesn't mean that that mission ever got cancelled. So we're not for selling tickets. We're not even for putting shows on. Ideally, you know, if I had my own way, we're for big outdoor shows with lots of fire and lots of joy and lots of magic. But if we can't be for that, that doesn't mean we stop, because that's not our mission. Our mission isn't to do that. That's just the mechanism by which we achieve it. Our mission is to give the best possible cultural life to the people of Holbeck. That's our job. And if they shut the theatres, then that job still exists. You just the tool you have to do it with isn't there anymore. And one of the things we talk about very clearly is, you know, we do pay what you decide. We bring big artists in and we make them perform in accessible ways. And if we've got a big cabaret in the car park, we've got a stage outside and the band's warming up and it's amazing and it's pay what you decide, but you're within earshot of our theatre and you don't know how to feed your kids in the morning, there's no realistic way you can turn up to that show and enjoy it. So therefore, we're just idiots making noise in your community without due respect. So there is a degree to which the whole of my community is of interest to me. Their mental health, their physical wealth, their financial health, the injustices that they face in a system designed to stamp on them, all of that is of interest to me as an artist. Because if I wanted to just put on work in a vacuum that just had people, I would go and do that. There are plenty of places to do that. I shan't name them here for fear of embarrassing them, but they exist. But I'm not doing that. What we're doing here is we're serving the people of Holbeck. So if the people of Holbeck all of a sudden get trapped in their buildings, in their homes, our job is to work out how to get some culture into their homes. Just as if the people of Holbeck tell me that they are hungry, well, it doesn't matter how good my show is. I got to help them feed themselves and their families before anything else. And that just struck me as absolutely bloody, absolutely obvious. And I think that sustained us for that 18-month period. It just struck me as that was the only reasonable response. That's why a theatre company runs a food bank, I think.
The book ends on a sort of quite positive note. You know, the reopening, I mean, things are not normal, but, you know, an element of kind of, as you say, getting back to doing outdoor theatre and, you know, almost a sort of rebirth of the institution of sorts. And it has this kind of, you know, wonderful positive note, really, that it maybe ends on. But I'm slightly kind of cheekily thinking, what about the rest of the story? And I'm intrigued to know sort of what's happening now, both in terms of the organisation and the club, and in terms of sort of your and Slunglow's work.
So, I mean, the brilliant thing I think about, or the thing I've been most pleased about since COVID, is that we had to put down those responsibilities. We couldn't carry on being a food bank to everyone who needed food, simply because it was being funded by people who would expect us in normal times to put on theatre. So there was a degree to which we knew we had to put down those responsibilities. We had to lay them down. And some really smart people said to us, but how are you going to be changed? How will you be different in the future as a result of these? And I think we honoured them best we could. You know, we started the community football club because one of the things we learned about our community when we were delivering the food was that we have the worst health outcomes of any ward in England, and we have absolutely no organised adult sport. And it was just very simple for us to kind of fix that and say, well, what do you want? And everyone told us a women's and a men's football team, and we created, you know, the Slunglow version of that. So the cost, you know, the strip's amazing, and it's free. So we did all the things you would expect us to do with a football club. But still, there are people exercising now in a place that they weren't before. And our biggest, the place we would deliver the most amount of food was the local primary school. So we're now in residence with the local primary school, and an awful lot of our family programming is being done by a small group of children from that school, because that is the kind of natural extension of that relationship once you take away, just as the food bank was the extension of the principles of service once you add COVID, once you take away the ability to be a food bank, what are you left with that's interesting to a theatre company? We are in service to the people of Holbeck, and so not the Holbeck. And actually, a few months ago, we decided at the AGM, we asked the members to vote us out. So we will leave the club at the end of this calendar year. And we will leave it principally because the future vision of this club, we could not find a way to share with the committee. The committee have a vision for this club, which is very clear, that involves specific communities, that involves behaving in certain ways, and that's absolutely fine. That is in according to the rules of cultural democracy, they absolutely they are, you know, that is to be honoured in some respects. However, that doesn't mean that me and mine have to spend our energy and money supporting it. That's just simply, you know, we have to have shared values, otherwise we move on. However, we leave the club kind of physically accessible, hugely renovated and entirely debt free. So I'm very proud of what we've done here. And I think one of the things that in the arts we really struggle with is the idea of everything has to be forever. And actually, it's how we end up with loads of compromised things that don't quite do what they were meant to do. And I think we will leave the club with quite light hearts, because we know that we are going on to... We're not leaving Holbeck. We're not abandoning our responsibilities. We're opening a new theatre next to our primary school, because, again, we're constantly evolving and developing and wondering how best can we serve. And the final thought, and this is all relatively new, so you kind of reach me live on this thinking, but Holbeck is a place that does not have enough. It just doesn't have enough of anything. And it only has one publicly facing space that we were running. And actually... we realise that that's a bit of a problem. You need alternatives. You need the kind of ability for different communities to go in different places. So the idea of us opening up another one was one that when we realised there was a chance, we kind of jumped at. I think if you ask that question to me in 2 years' time when we're in the new space and it's working, is that I would have the same answer I had for the food bank and the same answer that I had for the post-food bank, which is this is all just another chapter in one long story. And the story is very clearly about providing the best cultural life to the people of Holbeck, and what happens when you trust a small group of determined artists to do that and kind of give them enough money to cause trouble and then get out of the way. And I think that this is just the next really exciting chapter in that story.